Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has written a book that puts the largely nonviolent protests for social and racial justice today in context with the past. In fact, to understand the need for changes in how we police and how our criminal justice system works, we have to look back to the 1960s, where little progress in civil rights and continued police repression against nonviolent protests turned violent as the decade wore on. And in response, as my guest reported in an earlier book, the federal government's war on poverty soon became a war on crime, a war that continues to this day. Elizabeth Hinton is an associate professor of history and a professor of law at Yale University. She specializes in criminalization and policing. Her latest book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s, tells a story of racial unrest that manifests itself in over 2,000 violent incidents over a six-year period in large communities and small across the country. These incidents were called riots by government and law enforcement, but Professor Hinton prefers the term black rebellions. While history remembers the violence in Watts and Detroit and a number of cities after Martin Luther King's assassination, Hinton shares stories of repression and violent reactions in places like Cairo, Illinois, York, Pennsylvania, Rochester, New York, or Alexandria, Virginia. The book offers revelations as we grapple with our own 21st century struggles with race and policing. Elizabeth Hinton is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Elizabeth Hinton, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Richard. Pleasure to be here.
In your book, America on Fire, you write, to understand the movements for racial justice today, we really need to understand the period of the late 1960s and 1970s. What is important to know about this incredibly turbulent time in racial relations in American history?
So the civil rights and Black Power era were really a turning point in our country and a missed opportunity where federal policymakers could have embraced a different set of investments that would have pumped resources into communities in the form of educational opportunities and health care and job creation measures and an overhaul of deteriorating and dilapidated housing, among other grave social problems during this period. And instead, out of that decade, we get an investment in policing and surveillance and incarceration.
Yeah, if I could borrow the title from your earlier book, we gave up on the war on poverty and we turned to a war on crime.
Is that fair to say? That's incredibly fair to say. And of course, against the background of all this transition are both, you know, the nonviolent protests of the civil rights movement, but the violent political rebellions that emerged in thousands of American cities from 1964 to 1972, usually in response to incidents of police violence.
Yeah.
And so this period, and we don't often think about it this way, but in terms of civilian deaths and property damage, was the greatest moment of domestic bloodshed since the Civil War. And of course, in many ways, that parallel makes sense. It's a century later, and in many ways emerged as a result of the unfinished promises and legacies of the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Yeah, making a new second attempt to address the wrongs that weren't fixed after the Civil War. The racial unrest from this period are often referred to as, quote, riots. Of course, we in Tulsa know a little bit about how that word has been used over history. And you write that these several thousand events that took place from 65, 64 through about 72 should be called rebellions. Why that term?
It's really important that we understand this form of political violence as sharing many, if not all, of the same grievances as the mainstream civil rights movement, I mean, many of which I just listed. But in addition to protection against white supremacist terrorism and to police brutality, the rebellions were about expanded educational opportunities, decent housing, and jobs. And rather than actually contending with the underlying root causes that made tens of thousands of Black Americans feel as if they had no recourse after decades of nonviolent protests, but to engage in various forms of violent political protests, attacking police, throwing rocks and bottles at them, throwing Molotov cocktails, burning institutions, looting. These were the kind of common characteristics of these incidents. Instead of actually trying to understand where this form of protest came from, policymakers from Lyndon Johnson on down said, these are criminal acts, they're meaningless, they're senseless, they have absolutely nothing to do with civil rights. And in labeling this violence a riot, then the only solution becomes more police and more surveillance in these communities. And the police, of course, are the, you know, the very thing that causes, that had caused this violence in the first place. So it ends up in, you know, the terminology itself ends up creating this policy cycle that continues to elide underlying socioeconomic causes and that we're still very much stuck in today.
You know, your account turns the usual perceptions about these events on its ears. You just sort of explained it's not aggressive police actions reacting to Black violence, but Black violence reacting to aggressive police enforcement, overreactions to minor offenses, and failure to police offenses committed against the African-American population. Right. And the book is full of examples of this sort of reaction. It's interesting you say that, you know, the political leaders of the time referred to this as Black violence, as crime. It's crime. But they don't refer to the reactions of police to nonviolent protests, which oftentimes were violent, were felonious, as crime.
Right. That's a really excellent point. Right. And we see this time and time again, right down to our own time, right? Any, you know, police violence is always seen, at least initially, unless we have, you know, a nearly 10-minute video. But it's always seen as legitimate. It's always seen as justified in one way or another. And, you know, from the kind of post-war period onward, as the civil rights movement really gained momentum, any calls for racial justice are immediately deemed by many authorities as criminal. I mean, we see the brutal, thinking about just the brutality that many civil rights protesters, nonviolent protesters, endured throughout the civil rights movement with little or no repercussions for police officers really illustrate the dynamic that you're describing.
We know about the big outbreaks of violence that history has chosen to remember for us. You know, Watts in 1966, Detroit 67, some of the big outbreaks in more recent history, Los Angeles 1992, Miami and Liberty City in 1980, the outbreaks after Martin Luther King's assassination. But what your book details is this incredible number. Your index shows rebellions numbering in the hundreds for a number of years. I mean, we're talking about some years where it's, you know, 365 days in a year, and there's 500 to 600 outbreaks of these rebellions, as you say, in a given year. What's really interesting is places like Cairo, Illinois. You spend a great deal of time talking about the situation in Cairo, Illinois. Now, I've seen Danny Lyon's photographs from when the first efforts to desegregate Cairo took place. You know, there's a series of famous photographs where the African-American population is trying to desegregate the swimming pool, and Cairo reacts by basically closing the public swimming pool and privatizing it so it can still be segregated. But I had no idea of this long fraught history of abuses from the white population on its African-American population. Can you talk a little bit about Cairo?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Cairo story is exceptional in a lot of ways. In some ways in the way that Tulsa is exceptional, but also deeply reflective of American racism and is a warning to all of us about, you know, the ways in which racism literally can kill us, can kill our economy, can kill a town, is a disease that if left unchecked or allowed to proliferate, you know, ends up hurting all of us. And Cairo is at the southernmost tip of Illinois. It's basically, you know, it's basically the South, even though it's in a northern state. And it's a small town of, by the 1960s, like just under 8,000 people. And Black residents represented just under half of that majority. And, you know, this was a time, too, when the kind of white supremacist terrorism and racism that had been throughout most of the 20th century characterized by the Klan was now moving into the kind of political, a more genteel class of political and economic elite. And in Cairo together, the political and economic elites, the white political economic elites of the town who had resisted integration every step of the way, were deeply entwined with the police department to continue to enforce segregation, but also racial terrorism well into the 70s. And because of the winner-take-all voting structure in Cairo, Black people were locked out of all political power and held, you know, were locked out of employment opportunities, had no political power in the town, and were oppressed by the white majority population. And eventually, you know, following in 1967, during the long hot summer, just like in hundreds of other cities, a Black veteran from Cairo mysteriously died in the county jail, and residents rebelled for several days. And the long-term response to that was the formation of a new white vigilante group that essentially went on to terrorize the Black community for years. I mean, would literally, and, you know, this group comprised, you know, the prominent businessmen of the city and the district attorney and, you know, both the kind of establishment elites, but also, you know, common workers, and would stand on the Mississippi levee and shoot into the all-Black Pyramid Courts housing project. And eventually, the Black community began to fight back. They began, you know, with no other recourse, they launched both a violent and nonviolent campaign to keep their community safe and continue to demand rights. And so from the late 60s through the early 70s, Black Cairoites launched a boycott of the white-owned stores in the city because they said, we're not going to patronize your stores anymore so you can buy bullets to shoot at us. And, you know, meanwhile, the police department and the white supremacist vigilante groups were basically one and the same. As in Tulsa, during this period, you know, white men were deputized by the county to arrest and to shoot into Black neighborhoods without any recourse. So again, I mean, it was just, there was no protection from law enforcement and amid this continued oppression. And part of that is why the rebellion in Cairo endured for so many years.
This wasn't a short period of time. This went on over a number of years where the housing project where a good part of the African-American community lived was next to the levee. They would stand up on the levee, as you write it, night after night, you know, months at a time, just taking shots into that community. Everything had to be boarded up. No lights after dark because we're talking, you know, just... So it's not like it was a weekend in 1921. This was a couple of years or
it,
more.
It was years into the 70s. It was years into the 70s. And that's why, you know, and just like the common things that we think of as kind of hallmarks of terrorism in the segregationist South, like when, you know, young Black school children in Cairo would walk home, white men would stand there with German shepherds and stick their German shepherds on them. And again, there's no way, there was no... absolutely no protection for Black residents. So, you know, and this story also illustrates the way in which by the end of the, you know, by the end of the 60s, you know, after, and you mentioned the struggle to desegregate the swimming pool and the schools in Cairo earlier in the 1960s, after this decade of nonviolent protests, when there's still, you know, conditions hadn't changed for many and they're, you know, you're vulnerable to both state-sanctioned violence and also white supremacist terror, you know, there was a major shift in terms of the politics of the civil rights movement from nonviolent protests to self-defense. And we really see that happening in Cairo. But one of the, you know, again, the kind of the most devastating lesson that we can learn from this story is that, you know, eventually rather than, you know, concede to give the Black community basic rights in Cairo and to expand economic opportunities and educational opportunities for Black residents and young Black people, the white establishment, you know, held on, decided that white supremacy was ultimately more important. And as a result, the economy of Cairo tanked through the 1970s. Everybody who could leave did. Today, Cairo is a majority Black city. Many people refer to it as a ghost town with very little economic opportunities. And so this is why, you know, I say ultimately, rather than concede political and economic rights to the Black residents, the white establishment chose white supremacy, and as a result, the entire town suffered. As a result, their own livelihoods and families suffered. And I think that is a really grave warning to all of us about just how dangerous and destructive racism can be.
They destroyed this town in order to save it, at least from the white citizens' perspective. Yeah, you know, as you've heard in the last few years, and certainly during this last weekend, as the world looked on Tulsa, all the people who said, "I never knew this happened in Tulsa in 1921." This book is full of episodes all around the country that people should know happened in their community. One was in Alexandria, Virginia, which I think is very poignant towards our situation today. Tell me about Alexandria, Virginia, where it was a series of steps that ended up in the failure of the police to investigate a crime against the African-American population that was, I guess, the match that lit the fire.
Right. There's a whole chapter of the book dedicated to what happened in Alexandria in the late 60s. And, you know, this is in part to illustrate that, you know, of course there are what are commonly referred to as bad apple police officers who are, you know, particularly brutal and cruel. There's always been bad apple people with power. There are bad apple overseers, of course, too, during slavery. But these bad apple officers are usually a part of a much larger poisoned policing culture and system that often rewards or encourages their behavior and fails to protect residents from brutality. And, you know, this is another story, just like so many of the book in the book, that really show how rebellion emerges after residents' demands, after nonviolent protests are ignored and changes aren't made. And there was a police officer in Alexandria, Virginia, who terrorized young Black children in the community, you know, was notorious among Black residents for, you know, being particularly aggressive with Black children. And, you know, one incident just became this precipitating thing where this officer beat and chased a number of young Blacks, like 12 and 14-year-olds. And eventually, you know, the community demanded his removal, and the city did nothing. The community continued to protest for months in the fall, and then eventually a young Black teenager was shot by a police officer, and this incident then led to an immediate rebellion where residents burned many buildings in the downtown district for several days. And then, you know, it was after the rebellion that the community began to listen, but still continued to defend and celebrate the accomplishments of the bad apple police officer who had kind of sparked this growing movement to draw awareness and bring about changes to the culture of the policing department. I think one thing that's significant, too, in this period that we see in many other cities is that this is a story, too, about how many cities struggled and how many police departments and police chiefs struggled from the kind of policing in the era of Jim Crow, because, of course, this is Virginia. This is segregated Virginia. And, you know, policing after the Civil Rights Movement, when Jim Crow was supposedly abolished and Black residents enjoyed new rights like voting that they did not have before. And so, you know, you see these kinds of struggles in a number of cities. And this is why, too, you know, I think there's a perception that rebellion was kind of a Northeast phenomenon. But one of the things that my research really shows is that, as you mentioned, Rich, that it happens everywhere. I mean, it's across the United States. It's in the West and the Sun Belt and, you know, the Northeast and the industrial Midwest and southern, you know, rural communities and big cities. It's everywhere. And the timeline, which lists more than 2,000 rebellions that happened in the late 20th century, I would bet that, you know, many people can find their hometown or a place that they live.
Yes.
We are all really implicated in this. We're all implicated in both the bad apples, like the officer in Virginia, but also the poison tree, as I call it, of the system and of police cultures, where this kind of behavior is encouraged and where historically we have seen very little accountability or recourse for incidents of excessive force and police brutality.
You know, in so many of the incidents that you write about in the book, just with a little common sense could have been avoided, even with the strained relations between police and the African-American population. You write of, I think it was in Stockton, California, you know, two officers came into the project because there was a party going on probably in front of the buildings there. They come in, immediately they tell them to stop the party instead of, hey, can you turn it down? And so when things grow tense, what happens? 30 officers arrive in, you know, just a complete overreaction to this event. And then all of a sudden you have rocks, bottles thrown at these officers. And then the next thing you know, there's another overreaction. And then you have an episode of violence.
Right. And that's exactly, I mean, you just beautifully illustrated, Rich, you know, that point that you made at the beginning, which is that we often think that these incidents, that this form of political violence it just starts on its own, but actually it's in response to forms of police violence and also policing strategies that would never be enforced or implemented in majority white communities or middle class communities. You know, that common sense courtesy of, hey, can you turn it down kind of thing, or even breaking up a party without making arrests, you know, is much more likely to happen in a suburban community than in an all-black housing project in Stockton.
Yeah, they're asked to disperse and leave the area, and they're in their own homes.
Right, exactly.
And what's interesting, you spend time on the commissions of the year because in reaction to this violence, you know, the Kerner Commission there, and any community that had a huge outbreak, Cincinnati, they had commissions, and they offered solutions. And yet the leaders at the time, for the most part, gave lip service to it at best and continued with the role of aggressive policing and criminalization of behavior. And that has been with us ever since.
Yep. And that's why, you know, we have, I mean, going back to the Kerner Commission, which I think is so important, you know, which of course Johnson calls in 1967 during the Detroit Rebellion. And, you know, the Kerner Commission identified all of the solutions that we continued to ignore. They said, okay, if we want to stop, if we want to prevent rebellion in the future, if we want to stop this violence in our cities, then we have to go beyond the war on poverty. We need a major investment in low-income communities of color. We need a job creation program. We need a complete overhaul of public schools. You know, all of these really robust programs that the Kerner Commission suggested were completely ignored. And subsequent commissions, too, you know, usually after a rebellion, a state or local, what they were called then, Human Relations Commission, would come in and hold hearings and investigate what happened and identify all the structural causes. And yet, time and time again, the solution is always, well, we know that, you know, the major problems are socioeconomic ones, but in the meantime, we need to continue to invest in police. And we see that right down to our own time. And so I think, you know, we don't need another commission to identify the problems. The commissions only, you know, end up being kind of a stalling tactic, I think. You know, we can go right back to the Kerner Commission. And that's what I think, you know, these calls for defund are about, are really about making a different set of investments. We have to make a set of investments now beyond the police, because this decision to rely on the police and in prisons to manage the effects of material consequences of poverty and racial inequality as they appear through crime and violence, this strategy, this has been the post-civil rights strategy, and it has not worked to keep our most vulnerable community safe. And so, you know, we really need a different approach to public safety and a different set of investments that have been suggested time and time and time again.
My guest today is Elizabeth Hinton, Associate Professor of History and Professor of Law at Yale, and author of America on Fire, The Untold Story of Police Violence and Black Rebellion. Our last couple of minutes, very quickly, today you said there's a number of different, there seems to be a new coalitions of whites, blacks, gays, straights, all across the spectrum that are demanding change. And yet, and we also have surveillance tools, which are called cell phones, that are you know, shedding light on police violence, and it's in turn demanding changes. We've also realized that incarceration is not the answer in many states. We know that we've incarcerated as many people as we can, and we still have issues. And we're beginning to realize that incarceration doesn't work. But we're also not committed to the sort of systemic changes that the Kerner Commission outlined, the initial complaints that spurred violence in 1960, education, housing, jobs. What do we need to do to turn the corner on this history?
Yeah, so that is the question. It's a tough question. You know, one, we need to keep in mind that we know historically that this change and, you know, policymakers don't make changes out of the goodness of their hearts. It's usually the result of movements and organizing and pressure. And so I think about the history of the civil rights movement and labor struggles, and, you know, that inspires me and I think should inform us that we need to kind of keep the pressure on, keep mobilizing, keep protesting, keep filing lawsuits. That's what that's what in part made the protests during the summer of 2020, the vast majority of which were completely peaceful and nonviolent, what made last summer so successful and really pushed forward these conversations about racial justice and about police reform. I think the other thing, and this is in many ways a much kind of longer struggle, is that, you know, this is going to be a hearts and minds battle. We have to continue to build coalitions and build the political will to bring about a different kind of governance, one that is, you know, based in principles of equality, and one that is about, fundamentally premised on, a robust social welfare state that provides basic benefits and social needs to our citizens. And I think, you know, we've seen a big backlash to exposing and really reckoning with much of our history and the history of racial oppression in this country. And so I think that, you know, that struggle, that expanding education, political education, and really helping all of us recognize that we have much more in common and we have many more shared grievances than the divisions that have prevented this country from truly realizing its founding values and for being as cohesive and as egalitarian as I think it could be. So, you know, we have a long fight before us, but I am optimistic that I think the younger generation, my students and the generation who really grounded and organized and led the protests last summer are ready for a different kind of society.
Elizabeth Hinton, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Elizabeth Hinton is an associate professor in the Department of History and African American Studies at Yale University with a secondary appointment as professor of law at the law school. She is considered one of the nation's leading experts on criminalization and policing and the author of the new book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.